Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Peter St. Ange. Peter is an expert in many things. He is a bartender turned economist. He can go deep on geopolitics, so many things. So we covered Iran, Venezuela, counterterrorism operations in Ecuador for the United States. We covered tariffs. We covered really a range of topics. And ultimately, it came down to what is the impact on Bitcoin? Where does he see the world headed over the next 5, 10, 20 years? And I think you're going to find this fascinating. It was a great conversation. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Peter here. Peter, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm excited for this. We have, man, 2026, we have so much to cover. And I'm going to start with the most important thing. So you are a former bartender turned economist.
Yes.
So I have to ask you, what's the best cocktail?
It is not an impressive cocktail. I'm not proud, but my favorite is Kahlua and milk. Kahlua. Optionally, you can put vodka in it, which makes it a white Russian. Absolutely delicious. If you've never had it, it's addictive.
Okay. What was like the most popular cocktail that you served then? Like what was everyone ordering?
Almost everybody just does gin and X or vodka and X. So like a screwdriver, gin and tonic. Those are like 80% of orders are going to be really boring stuff like Coke and rum and Coke. Just pretty boring stuff. The pain in the butts are the frozen drinks and the freaking Long Island iced tea. You got to like clear your entire shelf.
Yeah.
For Long Island, like everything's in there. It's like, remember when you're a kid and you go to Burger King and you get the Coke and you're like, well, I like Coke, but I like Sprite too. And so you just go ahead and put everything in your, like, that's Long Island iced tea.
Yeah. Except for it's not all ready to just press a button and fill for you. You got to prepare it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess nowadays you probably have Long Island iced tea mix, I bet. Yeah. But like when I was coming up, we had to walk uphill both directions.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Okay, let's get into the less important stuff. You talked about on a recent video you did, one of your daily videos, which, by the way, I love. I think so does the rest of Bitcoin Twitter in the world. I think it was a must pass housing bill that somehow a CBDC or some sort of a reference to a digital currency of sorts seems to be slipped in. What's the nature of the bill? And then what was the language being used that you called that out?
Yeah, so they've got this housing bill. Everybody in America is pissed off that housing is so expensive. It's one of the big pieces of the affordability problem, along with healthcare is probably the other big one. And so Congress knows that they have to fix it. Inflation is the top voter issue. Before the war, inflation was actually really low. Like Trueflation does private sector alternative to government statistics on inflation. They scrape, I think it's like 13 million numbers, something insane. And they literally scrape them. They don't have economists who, you know, throw dildos at the wall and make up numbers, right? These are like actual direct scrapes. And according to them, inflation was down to 0.7% before the war. Which that is so low, like literally that is the point where the Fed starts trying to create more inflation. Like as long as you have a central bank, you're really never going to get that low. So that's essentially zero inflation with a central bank. And now it's up because gas exploded and then gas feeds through to everything else. So now it's like 1.5, 1.6. But the moral of the story is that inflation was actually very tame. But the issue is psychologically, because prices went up so much during Biden's term, people still feel like everything's really expensive. They still feel like inflation is really high, even if it's bumping along at 0.7%. Moreover, during the election, Trump said he was going to cut everything in half, right? This is how Trump talks. But anyway, houses are going to cut in half. Everything's going to be half the price. And of course, I mean, that's not economic. Like, even if you could somehow do that, like, you know, if you wave the magic wand and Caesar takes over and puts in all the good policies, you have Javier Milei take over the U.S. with the chainsaw. Even if you did all that, the Fed actually wouldn't allow that. They would create inflation. But having said, the issue is that voters are really pissed off about inflation. So they have to do something. They don't want to touch medical. There's a lot of donors. It's an absolute mess. That's just a landmine. So instead, they're looking at housing. So they have this housing bill. And they do some useful things in there. They try to get rid of red tape, local zoning, which is a big reason why houses are so expensive in San Francisco or New York. Rent control, punishing locations for rent control by withholding federal construction funds. So there's a couple of useful things they're doing. There's some other less useful things that they're doing, like allowing community banks to lend more money that they don't have. So that's fractional reserve banking. letting them get closer to the big too big to fail banks, which keep about 7 cents in the vault, whereas community banks keep about 10 cents in the vault. They're upset because they want to inflate just like everybody else. So that's the housing bill. And they're doing so. There's two ways that crypto, broadly speaking, intersects with it. And one of them is stable coins, where the ability to pay interest on a stable coin has now become sort of a political football that the House and the Senate are trying to use to get this housing bill through. And the reason for that is that fractional reserve banks, of course, don't want competition from a stable coin, which, given the Genius Act last year, stable coins have to be backed, in practice, backed with treasuries, which is essentially as good as cash. And so that means that a stablecoin then becomes a full reserve bank that pays 5% interest, whereas your bank has 7 to 10 cents on the dollar and pays zero interest and charges you a bunch of fees. So Wall Street, of course, is very strongly opposed to that. So they're trying to stick that in there to get that banned. On paper, it's banned, but like Coinbase has a rewards and loyalty program. Like, it's not really banned. So they want to extra double ban it. And then the other one that they snuck in there, which, like, this was I presume Ripple paid for it, but is this little detail in there that allegedly it's a CBDC ban. Republicans have done this a couple times. They do these CBDC bans, but the trick is the ban only, it is written in a way that it only bans what's called a retail CBDC. Okay, it does not ban a wholesale CBDC. Now, a retail CBDC is where you treat the Fed like a bank. Okay, so you've got basically U.S. government stable coins, CBDC. Those would replace the U.S. dollar. And those are parked at the Fed. And the Fed cannot go bust because it's a money printer, right? So the Fed will always be safer than a bank. And so, you know, the banker's fear, again, is that this time the Fed would wipe them out. Right? Because it's not that the Fed's fully banked, but the Fed's, you know, it's a money printer. So in order to prevent that, okay, they want these CBDC bans that only focus on retail, but they leave alone a so-called wholesale coin where the Fed does the CBDC to banks, and then banks can pyramid on that. And so the issue there is that the only thing that's keeping a CBDC out of law is that the banks are afraid of it. But if you do a partial ban of retail, then you have taken all the spikes off a CBDC. You have turned it into something that banks catastrophically fear, into something that, you know, banks get a cut. Sure, why not? Right. And so government itself always wants a CBDC because it gives them control. It gives them, you know, they can monitor what you're spending on. They can control it. They can literally, for instance, they could enforce negative interest rates so that if you don't spend your money, it melts. Right, which would be excellent stimulus for the next time there's a recession and they have an election coming. So governments always want this, right? They want the surveillance, they want the control. The problem with this partial CBDC ban is that it flips banks from being against the CBDC to being pro. Now, people might ask, like, what the hell is a CBDC bill doing, you know, doing in a housing bill? And that's how Washington operates, right? The game is you horse trade, you give people things. And in practice, the things you're giving are things that your donors requested. In this case, the bankers want a ban on retail CBDCs, but only retail CBDCs. Ripple also would like a wholesale because Ripple is delusionally imagines that they are somehow going to be the CBDC. That's not how it works. Governments don't give that kind of prime real estate away. But at any rate, that's what Ripple thinks. And, you know, Ripple is swimming in so much money because, of course, they too are a money printer. And so they, I believe that they channel a lot of that money. You know, when I and a team at Heritage Foundation, we were trying to figure out why, you know, because like the Republicans were running around doing this partial ban of CBDC. And we explained to them, you know, this is very dangerous because this flips the banks to the other side of CBDC. And they kept saying, yeah. And we were like, so change it. And they were like, can't do that. And we were like, you know, it's kind of like if you're an astronomer and you see this gravitational field and you don't know why it's there. You can see that stuff is reacting to some gravitational field. And so you have to assume there's a planet there. Right. You don't see it, but there's a planet there. And so there's there is some gravitational field happening in CBDCs that is pushing specifically for this partial ban, which effectively makes a wholesale CBDC, which is still government controlled, and just push a button, makes it much more likely.
So that, I was actually going to ask you something along these lines, because I think you've described CBDCs as government-run crypto with a centralized database, which is, I think, an apt description. However, something we talk a lot about the Bitcoin way is a concern of stable coins actually being this, like a Tether, for example, where they already censor transactions based on what the FBI tells them to do, being sort of this very seamless path to a CBDC. And also, never mind the fact that the government is completely inept and building out the infrastructure themselves, probably going to be catastrophic at best and, you know, much, much worse potentially. I mean, could you see like the stable coins themselves being they're privately controlled, you know, but really at the end of the day, it becomes a, as you describe, a government run crypto on a centralized database. Is that something that you could anticipate happening, or do you have less concern about that?
No, I think it's a good point. The trick is that a stable coin, so a CBDC is going to be sold as, you know, instant transfer, zero fee, like crypto or, you know, blockchain technology has certain benefits over centralized systems, basically speed and price. And, you know, when I was working with senators' offices, for example, Republican senators, they were excited about a CBDC because, for example, it would lower the costs of exporting corn. Okay, so cross-border payments are a big deal for the constituents they represent. And so the benefit of a private CBDC, a private stable coin, is that it removes those advantages, right? So you can have those cost and speed advantages in, you know, Tether, for example, in which case a CBDC brings nothing to the table. So that's the benefit of it, is that it basically guts the use case or the argument and a lot of the political support for a CBDC. The downside is exactly what you're describing, which is that fundamentally any centralized organization that the U.S. government can get its hands on, which is pretty much everywhere in the world. There's like five countries that the U.S. government isn't allowed to go arrest people in. Those are always going to be captured to a certain degree. So it's a trade-off. But yeah, the risk you're describing is real.
So, okay. So how likely, if you look out into the future, because I don't know where we're at in the legislative process on something like this, how likely is, do you anticipate this must-pass housing bill to be passed? What do you think ultimately gets incorporated in terms of a CBDC stablecoin? Like, do you think the yield on for stablecoins are coming, or do you think they're going to, the banks are going to win? How do you think this plays out, if you were to guess?
Yeah, I think it's a toss-up on both. The CBDC thing is more likely because there's so little attention paid to it. Most Americans don't know what a CBDC is. Like, they're not angry about a CBDC. So, you know, I and others try to raise awareness of it. You know, most Bitcoiners, I think, understand it, but most normies do not. So that could, you know, slip in there. The stablecoins one is interesting because, you know, traditionally banks have had much, much more lobbying heft. They're one of the biggest donor groups. They're up there with healthcare. Really, it's those two that own Washington, healthcare, pharma. And banks, you know, traditionally have basically gotten anything they wanted. So they would loosen the rules so they could, you know, take more risk or print more money or get bailouts or whatever it is. What we saw with the Genius Act is that if crypto, not Bitcoin, but crypto, sadly, there's not that much money in Bitcoin because we're not scammers. We don't have outrageous profits in our industry, whereas other companies do. At any rate, there's enough profit running around in shitcoins that they, during the Genius Act, they pretty much matched Wall Street toe to toe, which is pretty striking. I think that's really one of the sort of unsung, you know, plate tectonic shift last year, was that somebody took on the banking cartel and won. Now, they didn't win entirely, right? So it did ban interest, for example, but it was a toothless ban so far. So I think it's 50-50 whether, you know, does the shitcoin industry mobilize again so that they can outbid Wall Street? That's really the question.
But you think that's a real debate, and this isn't like Brian Armstrong and JP Morgan. You think this is a real them butting heads and not some sort of political theater where the outcome has been pre-negotiated? Because I've heard that, like, hey, behind the door, behind the scenes, like, these guys are sitting in backroom deals. They know what the end result's going to be, but they have to make it look like it's the freedom fighters versus the banks, or whatever, you know, the narrative is.
It's always possible. Policy is a small world, and a lot of these guys, like, there's no laws against coordinating your donations. You know, there's like laws against price fixing, but not coordinating your donations to put pressure on people. So, I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if that's what they're doing. The economic interests are definitely on the other side of it. So, you know, like, when they come into the battle, they're definitely on different sides of it. Stable coins do stand to drain resources from fractional reserve banking. Having said, you know, did they sit and have a steak dinner and work out some compromise that they can both live with? Which would probably look like, you know, allowing interest, but doing it in some way that it's only capturing the crypto people. It's not capturing the normies. And, you know, there's different ways you can structure that so that a normie would, like, your grandma is probably intimidated by the notion of opening a Coinbase account and then replacing her bank account with it. Now, she doesn't understand that if she were to do that, those stable coins are fully backed. Whereas her community bank up the street that puts out cookies at Christmas, that money is actually in some hedge fund in Peru, right? So she doesn't understand this. Right. But as long as she doesn't understand that, it's not an existential threat to the bank. So you can structure it in a number of ways so that from the bank's perspective, the damage is done within the crypto bros, which is not a large market for them anyway. A, they're young. B, a lot of their money is in crypto. It's not in dollars.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to sidetrack us for 1 second before I move on to the next subject. I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, like, your work at Heritage. What's sort of the take on Bitcoin? I still see a lot of gold bug sort of folks from, like, the places I would expect to see that. What's been the response? You going really hardcore into Bitcoin. Are people getting more receptive to that on the sound money front, or is there still a lot of resistance in your mind?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the funny thing about Bitcoin is it's progressing birthday by birthday. You know, so the 10 years ago, you know, the average Bitcoiner or whatever was 28. Now they're 38. So you do have a lot more people who are in positions of influence in normal organizations who understand Bitcoin, who advocate for it. So you are seeing a gradual shift within Heritage. When I joined, gold was crazy when I joined in 2021, and Bitcoin was just completely insane. Like, you know, you got to see a therapist. So I know Heritage has shifted massively. We are 100% pro gold, pro Bitcoin, anti fractional reserve banking. So we've shifted massively. Most of the think tanks in Washington have not. So they're generally hostile. They regard Bitcoin as like a sideshow, but it'd be way too risky to actually use it for anything important. They generally regard gold as a sideshow, even though, of course, gold has a heck of a track record. But policy circles like in Washington, I think they're several decades behind the rest of the country. So, like, whatever normal people are thinking about money, it takes a lot longer for that to percolate into Washington.
Okay. Okay. That's fair. Okay. Let's talk about the war in Iran. I'm having a heck of a time following this. It feels like every day there's new conflicting information going. I have to hit grok on everything I see on X to see what I can kind of confirm. What's your assessment of what has happened so far? What's transpired to the best of your ability? And then we'll talk about sort of the economic consequences downstream in a minute.
Yeah. So I don't think the war has turned out the way that Trump wanted so far. I think the original hope was that you would you would decapitate the regime, you would destabilize them, and then one of two things would happen. Either what happened in Venezuela, which is that the remainder of the government, somebody steps in and says, I'll take over, and can we be friends? What do you need from us? So that worked fantastically in Venezuela, and Venezuela is now basically a client state of the U.S. It does what we tell it to. Or their hope was alternatively that there would be this spontaneous, you know, Iranians would rise up and they would topple the government. So neither of those had happened. I think the Iranian leadership is much deeper than we expected. In other words, there's more layers who are like into this thing so they can just keep going. and the Iranian people have not risen up. That may be because 10,000 of them got murdered in January. They did try rising up. So I don't know if I should laugh about that, but it's sad. At any rate, for whatever reason, the Iranian people have not risen up. The regime is still capable of crushing dissent, of intimidating people. Now, having said, you know, Trump, one of the things that I think is unique about Trump is that he takes his promises very seriously. So I know from working in Washington, the people in the administration, there are people in the White House who sit and track every single thing Trump ever promised. And, you know, they're very eager to get a checkbox on that. Okay, most presidents don't. They just say crap. And Trump looks like he just says crap, but he actually does take that stuff seriously. And one of the big promises that he made in this war, even more than whether we get their uranium or the Strait of Hormuz or, you know, whatever the outcomes are, one of the biggest things he promised was 4 to 6 weeks. So I think that the war has not gone as maybe, you know, some of the promoters hoped. However, I think that Trump is very eager to stick approximately to his timeline. Pete Hegseth, I said, to stretch that to maybe 8 weeks or so. But I mean, we're coming up on that. We're about 2-3 weeks away. So if you look at sort of personality wise, you know, you've also got the midterm elections coming up. Even if oil prices go down tomorrow, it takes a while for the economy to recover from all this. It also, once the economy recovers, there's also a lag with perceptions, you know, so like if companies are firing people and if prices are going up, your paycheck doesn't make ends meet. If that fixes, it still takes a long time for voters to feel like that fixed. So the question is getting that in there by midterms, which, you know, they're what, 7 months away, but when you're talking about economic perception, 7 months is not very long. So there's a bunch of things that are pushing for a short war. On the other hand, if you look at, you know, you can look at prediction markets, say that we're probably 50-50, that it'll go into June. They're saying 25% odds it goes into 2027. If you look at oil futures, those are saying basically August is when oil futures start coming back down. So the difficulty at this point is like sort of everything is on hold. You know, Bitcoin prices, gold and silver prices, the economy in general, markets, of course, all of that is on hold for the war. And nobody has any idea how long the war is going to go. Trump is almost uniquely chaotic. I think that is absolutely intentional. He wants to keep the other side, you know, off balance. But the end result is, you know, you're even seeing now, like when Trump makes some noise how the war will end soon, the market reaction is relatively muted. You know, today he sort of floated that, you know, we might drop control of Hormuz, which raises the prospect of a much shorter war. And you know, the market jumped, but it didn't jump as much as it should have based on that. So I think that at this point, you know, on Wall Street, they're calling it headline fatigue, that just nobody knows what this president's going to do. I know because I make daily videos, right? And so, you know, I have to like make the video the night before. And I lay awake in a cold sweat wondering what the hell Trump is going to do tonight, because maybe like tomorrow's video, you know, I don't know, maybe he'll win the war or he'll, you know, what, like, who knows? So so it's tricky being an investor. Now, of course, if you're a true Bitcoiner, you're HODL, you don't care what's happening. And so it's not that big a deal. But for, you know, I guess you could argue there's like another Sigma class of Bitcoiner where they do care because every last penny is in Bitcoin and they got to pay the rent. So I guess for those people, they would care.
So I just began learning, and I'm scratching the surface as to how oil and energy flows about the world. If Trump, what you alluded to there, Trump's comment that maybe we end the war and the strait stays in Iranian control, or it stays closed or blocked, you know, largely. What is the impact on U.S. economy, I guess global economy, if that were to continue to be the case, even if the war ended? Because to me, that's from what I'm gathering, that's highly consequential, or could be. Is that fair or no?
Well, it's consequential in terms of the U.S. exiting the war. And the way that it's being framed a lot in the media, they're focusing on his comments saying that the rest of the world has to handle the strait on their own. So if they want the oil out of the strait, then you guys have to go take it. You have to man up, grow a pair. Realistically, if the U.S. declares victory and goes home, then at most Iran would put a tax, a toll, on ships going through the Gulf. They're already, or going through the Straits, they're already doing that. I don't know if they're doing it today, but they were doing it in the recent past, where they were charging each ship $2 million. That comes out to about $1 a barrel. Okay. So, like, they'll just pay it. You know, realistically, the Europeans, Japan, Korea, they do not have the force projection where they can actually do anything about it. Iran's neighbors don't want to do anything about it because it would be a mess. China is sensitive, but they also don't want to do it. I think what China is afraid of right now is that their air defense systems are apparently garbage. There's speculation that they executed the guy who was the head of the missile defense, right? It failed in Venezuela, it failed in Iran. He's either disappeared or he's executed. I think China doesn't want to do anything militarily because they're concerned that all of their stuff is garbage. And if the whole world knows that, they lose leverage with Taiwan, they lose leverage with India. Like, they have a lot of neighbors who they have various conflicts with. Vietnam, you know, they're sort of in a permanent Cold War with Vietnam ever since they got their butts handed to them in the 70s. So I think China definitely doesn't want anything. So worst case scenario, which I think would be a nice scenario, is that the U.S. declares victory and goes home. And I, you know, Iran probably tries to tax oil. Dubai and Saudi and Iraq won't like that. But you know what? They have big, beautiful militaries. If they want to do something about it, they can. So I just had a tweet earlier where I was saying, you know, that it's too early to dream big. But there is the possibility that because of this war, NATO could break. Right? Trump's fighting with NATO because they're closing their airspace when, from his perspective, we need them. So NATO could break, and maybe we could shift the rules now where, like, China has to protect its own oil. Like, we don't do it for free anymore.
Interesting. So to what extent have you, like, as you've watched this unfold, the war, what are you... I tend to imagine that the average normie probably isn't seeing this, but there's probably some metric or some data that you're seeing that you're like, man, like, this is a glaring example of just how fragile the fiat system is, the supply chains that fiat have constructed are. Is there anything in particular you could point to that if someone's like not really clear on why, you know, why fiat is garbage and why Bitcoin might fix some of the challenges we face, that you're like, this war demonstrates that?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that what fiat does is enables all of these adventures, right? So, you know, if you go back, I mean, really for the past 100 years, every time governments screw something up, the way that they get out of it is that they shoot their central bank, shoot $1 trillion at it over and over until the problem goes away. And the end result is that every crisis converts into inflation. But what it also does is it finances every crisis. So, like, the central bank becomes the venture capitalist of the crisis industrial complex. So, you know, America, let's see, we have a close to $2 trillion deficit at 7% of GDP. That is deep war level. Okay. We were at relative peace the past couple of years. 7% in peacetime is obscene. That's, you know, third world basket case territory. And why is that possible? Because the Fed stands ready to print it all. The Fed fundamentally backstops it with a giant money printer. The example I like to give is COVID, right? So if you imagine some random country like Canada, and you get the COVID thing and you have the staff meeting and they all say, okay, so what are some options? And let's say you don't have a central bank. So you have some junior bureaucrat who says, okay, I got a crazy idea. Let's shut down the entire economy. Tax revenue will drop by half or more, but that's okay because we just lay off all the federal workers. We just, you know, we just cut all the government expenditure. So you would get fired, right? You would get sent to, like, you know, the deep north up in
Siberia.
Yeah, you'd be out of here tomorrow, right? The only way that plan could work to shut down the entire economy and pay all the voters to sit on the couch so that they support lockdowns and, you know, they watch dancing nurses instead of going to work. The only way that you could make that work is with a gigantic money printer. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened, right? So they did the lockdowns. They you know, did the virtue signaling. I uniquely care about grandma. You know, anti-vax bozos have blood on your hands. Very, very expensive virtue signaling, right? It cost them, well, I think at one point it was $7 trillion that the Fed balance sheet increased. But you know, they were able to do it. And not only could they do it, but shooting all that money at it made everything go up. Yeah. Right? It was weird. Like, you shut down half the world economy and all the stocks went up, Bitcoin went up, gold went up, everything went up. Amazing, right? Because they shoot the money first goes into markets and then it dribbles out into consumer prices. So the, you know, when I look at this war, the near term, the fiat is helping in the sense that, you know, like everybody knows, markets know if everything goes to hell, then they'll just shoot money at it. And so, you know, the so-called Fed put. But the wider issue is that the reason that we are in this war, the reason we are in all the wars, the reason we're in World War One, as Seyfedin discusses, all of those are because of central banks. They are the venture capitalists of the crisis industrial complex.
Interesting. So you mentioned Venezuela. I have to ask, to me that, like, I feel like I woke up, saw the news, blinked, and then we moved on to something else. We did depose a world leader. And to be fair, we had, I'm not an interventionalist. You could probably guess that about me, Peter, but, we had someone come on as Spaces that we did, who was from Venezuela living in the States. And he was talking about how he's like, Venezuelans are cheering this on. Like, it was
for sure. Absolutely.
It was bad, you know, and mm-hmm. I can sympathize while not agreeing that I want my tax dollars or, you know, my children to have to pay debt on some intervention that, you know, right. That doesn't directly affect me. But what was your take on what was that? Was there maybe like a more it felt like just this impromptu, like, we're going to just pull this thing together. But then I hear about people talking about, hey, migrating to a multipolar world. We need to own the Western Hemisphere with the Monroe Doctrine. Like, how do you look at what happened there? And is there sort of a continuing story in the background that we're so focused on Iran now that we're not even seeing with Venezuela?
Yeah, I mean, so the Venezuelan regime is garbage. They're communists. I encourage anybody to depose communists at any time for any reason, using their own money and their own lives. Of course, I don't want the government to do this because there's a lot of crappy regimes in the world. And we would spend everything we have doing it. Plus, we're already $2 trillion in debt, which is, you know, already inviting a financial crisis. So I would prefer we not do it. But the whole dominating the hemisphere, you know, Switzerland dominates nothing, right? It has no external military. It invades nobody. It has no sphere of influence. Liechtenstein is arguably its sphere of influence. It dominates nothing, and it does just fine. Why? Because it goes out and buys crap. Okay, it can buy lithium and it can buy oil and it can buy food and all the rest of it. So it's, you know, to me, it's a fallacy. Like, why do you have to dominate stuff? Like, to what end? Mm-hmm. You know, are being a major player in the Middle East, what precisely has that done for us? Us being influential in Africa, again, what exactly did we get for that? So I think it's, you know, I've met Venezuelans. They are absolutely thrilled at Trump. They love the fact that he told the oil companies, you can't just take the revenue out. You know, like, the oil companies had longstanding lawsuits from when their resources were seized by the government. And he said, no, we're going to put those on the back burner because the resources are for the Venezuelan people. I think if you're Venezuelan, you should absolutely love this president. I mean, he's just been astounding. However, that's not his job. And he has said this 100 times. He said, you know, when people talk about how nobody likes you in Europe, and he says, my job's not to be liked in Europe. His job is not to be liked in Venezuela. I sympathize with Venezuelan people. I encourage any, you know, bored billionaire to go raise an army and go do it on his own. But fundamentally, yeah, it's not our war. There's a lot of wars in the world, and we can't afford them all. We can't even afford what we're doing now. Yeah, a lot of Somali learning centers that need to be funded.
Exactly. There's and potholes that need to be paved would be my preference. So do you think the reason for that, are you optimistic about Trump's intentions that it was help the Venezuelan people, or was this an oil natural resources play? Is there something else happening that is, or at least that Trump perceives to be benefiting the American people long term, or something else?
Yeah, I think for better or for worse, Trump, whatever filter Trump used to have is not there anymore. He gives speeches now where he's like, you know, I like to be around dumb people. Dumb people, you know, I don't like people who are too smart. The man has no filter. Okay. Yeah. Tactically, that's not a good thing to say, even if that's true. At any rate, he's got no filter. So I honestly, I take him at his word. I think he invaded some sympathy for the Venezuelan people. I think more of it was that the Venezuelan government was causing a bunch of problems, right? They were sending the narco boats. That's a legitimate issue. The number of Americans who die every year from overdoses is roughly the number who died in the entire Vietnam War. That is like a legitimate self-defense issue. There's other smaller things. For example, Venezuela was not, you know, they emptied their prisons to a certain degree and just dumped them all north so we could have them, and they were not taking them back, right? So we would arrest these criminal Venezuelan migrants, and then Venezuela would say, yeah, no, we don't want them, you know.
Figure it out.
I don't know. So, I mean, there were some legitimate grievances. I think the single biggest one was that he genuinely doesn't want China having influence in Latin America. You know, China has been very big into buying friends with the checkbook. I mean, frankly, I don't know why we care if like Swaziland is friends with China, like, you know,
right.
Yeah. What are they going to do? So yeah. It doesn't bother me, but I think that it does bother Trump. He wants the U.S. to be the uncontested power, at least in the Western Hemisphere.
Okay. And we'll get out of Central America, South America here in 1 second, but in the midst of all of this, I saw the we were doing some sort of an anti-terrorist campaign in Ecuador. Was that just that, and it happened to come on my radar, or was there, in your view, some other play at hand?
We do those everywhere. I think you know, people have tried to tally how many bases we, like formal bases we have. I don't know, 150. I mean, it's astounding. You know, every so often you only hear about it when somebody gets killed. And so like somebody will get killed in, what was it the other year? Niger or something. And then people were like, what? Why do we have soldiers in Niger? Yeah.
The good thing is all of our intervention is teaching people, Americans, geography that they don't learn in public school.
Which again, what are you going to do with that? What are you going to go vacation in Niger?
Everyone knows where Ukraine is. Everyone knows where Iran is now.
Everybody knows where the Strait of Hormuz is now.
Yeah, and we're all experts on it too. Yeah, the yen carry trade. I became an expert on that overnight.
That's true. Yeah.
So, let's talk a little bit just sort of macro, I guess. We U.S. debt recently hit $39 trillion. I think the, what would it be? The CBO is looking, you know, a decade out, and we're talking the U.S. debt doubling here very, very quickly. And yeah, it tends to be very conservative projections, obviously, that the government's going to put out. What do you, I assume you agree that's going to get higher. Any other comment on that before I proceed with questions though? Is that where we're going?
Yeah. I think absolutely. It's going to keep getting higher. You know, unfortunately the incentives are, there is no predator. There's no natural predator spending in Washington, and everybody, no matter what the party, you benefit, you as a senator or a congressman or a president, you benefit from spending more. So everybody wants to spend more. There is no countervailing force. The only limit on it is either a crisis or, going back to that central bank with the crisis industrial complex, you know, if you get a crisis, the Fed will shoot the trillions at it, get out the bazooka, trillion after trillion until it goes away, which converts into inflation. So I think fundamentally, it will keep going to a crisis. It will probably take longer than people expect. You know, people in the 1970s thought that we were right on the edge of apocalypse. And 50 years later, we're not. Anybody who invested the apocalypse in 1978 lost money. So, you know, it'll probably take longer than it seems. But unfortunately, I think there's, you know, we just had a natural experiment with Doge where Trump, believe it or not, had been hostile to federal spending. Every single budget in his first term, he tried to cut 100, 200 billion, big money back then. Every single time Congress walked away. Doge, of course, you know, Elon is a force of nature. He can do things no mortal can imagine. Bounced off Washington, didn't even make a dent. By their own tally, Doge claims 200 billion in savings. Well, that all got gobbled up in a single year from Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, no doubt welfare fraud. It gobbled all of it up. And that was one-time Doge. That was 1 year it gobbled up. Next year, it's going to gobble it up again and again and again. So we just had a natural experiment. We had the perfect storm. We had, you know, Republicans promised they were going to slash federal spending for 50 years. We had unified Republican control. We allegedly had fiscal conservatives. We had Elon Musk, you know, possibly the most capable human on earth heading this thing up. We had Trump, who by all accounts is, he is very hostile to the federal government. He does not believe that it is a force for good. All the stars aligned. Every single planet was in sync. Nothing. So I think the takeaway from that is it's hopeless. And I think that's why gold and silver were taking off before the war. Right? They exploded last year. I think silver was up 3x, just obscene numbers. Right? They were both in backwardation, indicating severe supply stress. So I think that precious metal saw that. Now, Bitcoin, I think, didn't move up because Bitcoin still had a big run that came from, you know, there was a lot of hope when Trump won. He said he was going to pay the Bitcoiners back. I think that has not turned out as much as people might have expected. So Bitcoin sat that one out for that reason, or put differently, it got its rally early. But gold and silver basically said they took one look at what happened to Doge, you know, given the Republican Congress, given Trump, and they said, it's game over, right? There is nothing stops this train, as Lynn Alden says.
Yeah, no, I think that seems about right. Because I'm no longer real optimistic when anyone takes office, even if it's someone who I, you know, align with or I like some of the things that they say. To me, I look at the to your point, there is no one who is incentivized to go after the spending. There are too many handouts, votes to buy, or you could say accumulate if you want to be a little more gracious. But I would have guessed, I knew Doge was not going to fill the deficit, right? That to me just seemed insane. I was a bit surprised that they couldn't muster up a little bit more political capital to do something meaningful that wouldn't be gobbled up in the first year. But maybe in retrospect that, you know, I kind of threw my hands up. I don't know if, going into Doge, what was your anticipation? Like, did you think they were going to bounce right off of Washington, or did you think there was a real shot at making some meaningful impact?
The problem is that if you're really going to make a big impact, there's only so much you can do as president. A lot of it has to come from Congress. Mm-hmm. Because there are these forests of laws that are passed in there. They're crony laws, and they protect all this stuff, right? So when people complain about the Obama judges and the Biden judges, those guys are downstream of these corrupt laws that are stuck in there by Congress because some donor paid them to. So to get rid of all of that garbage, to get rid of the spending, to, you know, get rid of the fraudulent, you know, all the money going out to Minnesota and California, to do all that, you need Congress to do it. And Congress cannot do it because of something called the filibuster, right? So you need 60 votes to pass. Almost never does one party have 60 seats. There was a time when they would horse trade and they would sit in the back room over cigars. They would cut deals. They don't do that anymore. So in practice, nothing major can get passed anymore. So we're essentially frozen more or less at the FDR revolution. So, you know, FDR gutted the Republic. It was essentially a constitutional coup. He, you know, imposed this administrative state, the deep state. That is essentially frozen in place because of the filibuster. Now, I guess the good news, the short-term bad news, long-term good news is that it looks like the Democrats are planning to cut the filibuster next time they get power. If they do that, then short-term, a lot of terrible stuff happens. Basically, whatever Kamala promised happens if you get rid of the filibuster. However, it moves us a lot closer to finally being able to break this logjam because, you know, what I think the past year has shown us is that the FDR superstate is indestructible the way it is. You can't get it out without breaking the filibuster.
Okay. So are you do you adhere to the thesis of the big print? Is that what we do with the $39 trillion in debt, the war, the everything going on? Like, are you and Larry Lepard pretty well aligned on where you think this is headed?
Yeah, I think absolutely. So, all right, take Bidenflation. So depending on how you count it, it was at least 20%. That effectively paid off $8 trillion of debt, or what, $7 trillion of debt. Right. So, you know, because when you have inflation, the economy keeps up with inflation sort of by definition, but the debt does not because the debt is in nominal dollars. So that effectively, that was the biggest, like, forget the 1990s, right? Bidenflation paid off an enormous amount of debt, $7 trillion in debt. Now, it did it in a horrible way, right? It did it by gutting the American people and impoverishing us. And now, you know, kids moving in with their parents is at Great Depression levels. I mean, it was absolutely horrific. But if the only thing you care about is the debt to GDP ratio, then you loved Bidenflation. You would want a heck of a lot more of it. You know, famously, the Weimar government in the 1920s, the national debt was eating the country alive. I think it was three or four times GDP. This is from absolute memory. Anyway, it was very large. It was larger than our debt is today. And they had a couple years of hyperinflation, and then the national debt cost the same as a loaf of bread. So that's the concern, is that if you let things keep running, and, you know, we've already got the template. Or I was talking earlier about the Fed shooting a trillion in every crisis. We already have the template, right? If anything goes wrong, every time short-term interest rates spike, for example, which they do about every 2-3 years now, that used to be called a crisis. Now the Fed just shoots money at it, right? So all of these disasters, they all convert into a big print. Now, they're going to try to make it go slow, because I like to joke that we don't have a gold standard, but we have a pitchfork standard, which is that, you know, like, why does the Fed try to keep inflation around 2%? There's no scientific reason for it. It's because they know empirically that's, you go beyond that and people start getting upset. And then they start putting pressure on Congress, and then Congress, you know, starts to clip their wings. So in practice, you know, it's like a gasoline thief. You know, you take 1 gallon a night. You don't drain the whole tank at once, right? Because they're going to notice that, right? You take a little bit. You take like a quarter gallon every single night. You're going to make a lot more doing it that way than you will stealing all the gas all at once. So, I don't think it's going to come all at once. They are going to try to restrict it. Central banking has it kind of down to an art where, you know, they can just shave off a little bit here and there. And by the way, they steal a lot more than it looks. They don't steal 2% a year, right? People think, okay, 2% inflation, so the Fed printed or stole and gave to somebody 2% of all the money in the world. No, they took a lot more than that, because an economy naturally is deflationary, right? Because you have all the money in existence, you have all the stuff. If your population goes up, if you're more productive, if you're using computers and AI and whatever to make more stuff, then you have more stuff, you have the same dollars, so you actually have deflation. The stuff gets cheaper. So what the Fed manages to do is soak all that up. Probably the biggest deflation we had over the past 20 years was China. Right, so when I was a kid, buying a toaster, you had to think hard about that. You had to like shop around. You had to go buy Consumer Reports and figure out which toaster was good. Why? Because adjusting for inflation, they were like $150. Right, today, you can get a toaster for $7.99. Maybe not today, but they're very, very cheap because of China. So China was a massive deflationary impetus that created, you know, political issues because it stole a lot of jobs. But in terms of inflation, quality of life, consumer spending, we should have just gone through over the past 20 years, we should have gone through this massive deflation, right? We should have got like 30% deflation. All of that was gobbled up by the Fed and handed to, you know, Wall Street, to the federal government, subsidizing debt. So they take a lot more than it looks, probably on the order of $600-700 billion a year, right? So that effectively, you know, they're borrowing so much that the debt keeps growing. But if they get to a crisis, you know, a lot of the sort of black pill crowds imagines that, you know, there's going to be this great crash and then the righteous shall prevail. And no, it'll all convert into inflation, which is nice if you happen to be a Bitcoiner or a gold bug. Silver is a little bit trickier. You will inherit the earth.
It's so interesting. I actually had this conversation with a friend recently. I was explaining that even if you take them at their 2%, you know, CPI, like that's how you perceive inflation. I was like, first of all, that's not really what inflation is. I mean, look at monetary inflation. You're looking at probably 7.5%, 8% or something like that over the last two decades. And so that's really what they're stealing from you, because you know that 2% is a lie, but prices should be decreasing by, I don't know, let's say 3% a year. Like, the delta is 10%. Like that's what you're being robbed of. Like you could be getting 10% wealthier each year, or at least you could be, you could be 10% better off, I guess you might say. And, it's just so distorted, but honestly, it's fractional reserve banking, central banking. It's all of these forces that are so opaque to most people that you have to really be interested and really be curious and study hard and read a lot of books and listen to a lot of good podcasts. that most people just have no idea. Like if they heard what you just said, I think they'd completely misunderstand just how serious, you know, the situation was.
And, you know, if you paint a picture of what's possible, I think that's really important for people. Like they might understand Bitcoin on a life raft, you know, view. Like, okay, I got to understand you want to protect yourself from the fiat system. But in terms of the wider question, like what happens to society if you return to sound money? And there, you know, you can look back at the period before the, you know, two worst policies in American history, which were the income tax and the Federal Reserve. Those came in at the same time. They essentially gave the government the ability to seize unlimited quantities of society's resources and then use those for wars or cronies or whatever it is. So you can look back at the period before then. I call it the top hat singularity. At the period from about 1875 to 1913, it is an astounding period. Everything was invented. If you take every single thing that Elon is famous for, every one of those was invented in that 40-year period. Computers, yep. Hyperloops, rockets, airplanes, helicopters, everything, magnetism, electricity, telephones, everything was invented in that 40-year period. I think people have no idea what we've lost. Since then, we have been running on the fumes, commercializing everything that was invented in 1875 to 1913. So in other words, if you imagine a counterfactual where we did not do the Fed, we did not do the income tax, therefore we did not have World War I because there was nobody to finance it. They would have mucked around for, you know, 6 weeks and you know, on the border and called it a day. If we didn't have those things, it's depressing to think where we'd be. You know, like Starbucks. People working at Starbucks would make a $250,000, meaning that they would only do it for like 5-7 years and they go backpack for their, you know, people would retire at 35, immortality. Just imagining all the things we would have if we hadn't strangled it in the crib in 1914.
Yeah, I've said before that it's hard to imagine a world where we hadn't hampered nuclear and where we could have accepted Bitcoin in 2009 as the form of money. Like you combine those couple of things. And you're right. Like I've actually given those examples before. I think the combustion engine was invented around the same time. I was trying to explain this to another friend. This was like a year ago. That all of the cool things Elon does, or you know, anyone, you know, name your tech billionaire. All of it is incremental improvement on technology that is 120 years old. All of it. And they're like, no, this is like the most technologically crazy age. I was like, no, imagine going from, I have to open my windows when it's 95 degrees out just to get a breeze to like, I have air conditioning in my home. I can be comfortable 24 hours a day. That is a way bigger lifestyle upgrade than Elon shooting rockets off, which has no bearing on my life, right? So I think it's just hard to conceive of if you don't go do the studying of the history. Peter, I actually just typed this down because I didn't have this on my list, but tariffs. I have completely lost track of where we stand on tariffs. I was following this for a while. I would love your opinion on tariffs generally. Your view of tariffs as an Austrian and. If you have any sense as to where we currently stand with, 200 some odd countries, would love to hear your analysis.
Yeah, it kind of dropped out of the headlines. So broadly speaking, a tariff is a form of a sales tax. It's a sales tax on a particular class of goods, imports. Like all sales taxes, it's therefore, you know, evil. It transfers the resources of the government. It drains the lifeblood of the people, et cetera. So tariffs are terrible for the same reason taxes are terrible. Having said there, Trump had two goals with his tariffs, which is why I've been generally going easy on them, which are number one, to get other countries to reduce their trade barriers, which, you know, if you can threaten other countries and they remove their trade barriers and then you remove yours, that creates a better world for everybody. I think everybody agrees that. The second one is to reshore production. So to bring factories back to America. That worked with Ronald Reagan, for example. He threatened the Japanese with tariffs. They moved production to the U.S. to the point where almost half of Japanese cars sold in America are actually made in America. And the Japanese don't care, right? They just want to make money, okay? They'll make it in America. They'll make it in Japan. They'll make it in China. They don't care that much where they produce it. the country of Japan may be nationalist, but Toyota doesn't care, right? They're paid to make profits. They don't care where they make it. So those were the two goals. Now, the reshoring, I think, is that was turning into the more interesting of it because Trump, the way that he was negotiating with countries was he was saying, look, I can hit you with this catastrophic tariff, or you can build a bunch of factories in America and I'll let you off easy. And that's what countries were going for. So Korea, Japan, Europe, Taiwan, Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, all of these guys, they were promising a combined, it was over $4 trillion of investment that they were going to build. So, you know, Taiwan Semiconductor is building a $100 billion plant in Arizona, a whole bunch of projects. And the rule of thumb is that every $1 trillion is worth about 1 million jobs. Right. So that's enormous. Right. That would cut our unemployment rate in half. That was a very big deal. So this is what Trump was getting. Right. He was threatening with these massive tariffs, you know, 40%. And the country would say, OK, you got me. I'm going to take all, like Taiwan took 99% of its tariffs off American goods. It was obscene they ever had them because we protect them for free. But anyway, setting that aside, they got rid of 99% of the tariffs and, you know, they sent, I don't know, $300 billion or something. Which would be, well, that'd be about 300,000 jobs that they were going to be creating in America. So Trump has been very transactional. He's been very, very clear. Japan, Taiwan, Korea, they understand they're smart. Their media is a lot smarter than ours. And they sit down and say, okay, they say, look, Trump is transactional. Here's what Trump wants. You know, he wants factories. He wants the trade barrier. He wants that, And they sit down and they give it to him to stay on his good side. So in light of that, right, on the one hand, tariffs on themselves are bad. On the other hand, Trump was getting so much good out of them. And, you know, if you look at most countries, like in Africa or Brazil, for example, tariffs have failed catastrophically. When you read like in The Economist magazine or the Financial Times and they criticize tariffs, they're thinking of those tariffs. Now, the key there is that if you pass tariffs and you fail to make it attractive to produce in your country, right? This is what typically happens in Brazil or Africa or somewhere. They say, okay, we're going to tariff everybody, but if you try to produce here, you know, the tax rates are going to be astronomical, the red tape, you're going to bribe everybody. You know, who knows if the minister of whatnot wants to give your business to his son, maybe he will, you know, property rights, right? So in those contexts, yes, tariffs are catastrophic. Brazil, Africa should not have tariffs. They're not adult enough to handle tariffs. Okay. But what Trump was doing here was, first of all, he was frankly extorting the foreign investment into the country. Secondly, he was trying to get tax rates down, right? He cut the income tax, the corporate income tax in half, which is the most important for investment. He cut taxes across the board, the one big beautiful bill, which extended his first term tax cuts, slashing regulation, right? Zero help from Congress. He got rid of the carbon dioxide endangerment rule, which claims that CO2 is a pollutant, huge issue in manufacturing, basically wipes out small manufacturers. So he was getting rid of the two biggest problems to manufacturing in America, which are the tax rates, especially for small businesses, and the regulations. So if you're doing that, if you're putting tariffs on, you're actually making it attractive to produce in your country. Right. Just kind of to imagine the end result of that. Like if Trump were king, then he would put the corporate rate at zero. He would get rid of all of the regulations, you know, basically roll us back to the 1950s when, you know, people were not eating each other in the street. But we didn't have this crony regulatory state laid on top of it. If you were to do that, you wouldn't have to threaten countries. Everybody in the world, like every Japanese company would be trying to move to, you got zero tax, you got less regulation. You know, we have tons of oil, tons of resources in the US. They would be falling over themselves to move here. So in light of that, I think that, that's why I've been supportive of his tariffs, even though in general, I oppose most tariffs. Now, where do we stand? The Supreme Court struck them down under the law he was using, which is called IPA. There's three other laws with four other authorities. So things like discriminated against U.S. exports, national security threats, which, by the way, they're using national security for upholstered furniture. So that's a very expansive definition in Washington. So they can basically block anything through these other laws. The thing is that those have to be litigated as a process. So that's slow. So what he's trying to do in principle is to replace the IEEPA tariffs. The IEEPA tariffs were super clean. That was, you could declare an economic emergency and just hit anybody with anything. These other tariffs has got to go through step by step. So he's trying to recreate them. He's trying to homebrew them. The problem is that takes time. And all these countries that were going to invest billions or trillions of dollars, they're all waiting to see how that pans out, right? Because maybe they won't have to do it.
Yeah. So you would say you approve of the notion of tariffs in this sort of unique case by virtue of the context in which they're happening, the intent that you perceive there to be. How would you rate the execution? Because this when we were talking about this on our show, it just felt like we were getting jerked around with, okay, we're extending, you know, no tariffs until this date and then this date, and then we're going to slap a new one on. And on one hand, maybe that, you know, I've heard enough references to 4D chess to be skeptical. However, I don't understand how a lot of this stuff works in practice. Maybe the volatility that we saw with the tariffs was by design. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that's the great debate with Trump is, you know, in the back of his mind, is he running a TV show where he's got to keep it interesting every month? And so something weird has to happen.
It feels like,
you know, or is it 4D chess? So, you know, the charitable take, I mean, it would be that this is intentional. It's a way to force countries. You know, I think that partly when he first came in, he wanted to communicate to countries that, you know, for a long time, there's been these very narrow norms of what the U.S. would do. Like, if you piss off the U.S., then we'll, you know, do this tiny little whatever. We'll not issue as many loan guarantees for your companies or so, like just tiny little tweaks, right? And I think he wanted to send the message that, look, everything's on the table with me. All right, I will take Greenland. I mean, I will do things you haven't even dreamed of. So I think that was absolutely intentional, right, is to raise the threat level. And his goal is to get countries to fold. I don't think he wants to go to war with countries. He wants to bully and intimidate them. And, you know, that's his job. He represents the American people. He doesn't represent the European people. Screw them. His job is not to represent foreign countries. Now, I encourage Europeans to have nationalists who represent them. I don't dislike Europe or Korea or whatever. But the job of every country is to advocate for itself. And I think that that's what the bullying was. Now, having said, you know, yanking them around does something interesting, because if you yank the rates around enough, at some point, countries just, they can't make a deal anymore. Like, in other words, negotiation becomes impossible. You know, there's a famous game from the 1950s called Chicken, where, you know, two hot rodders aim cars at each other, and then whoever swerves first loses, right? He's the weak guy. You got to be careful about words. I'm not exactly sure where this is going to post. He's the weak guy. At any rate, there's a way to win Chicken, which is that you remove your steering wheel and you hold it out the window. Okay, so now the other guy has to, he's got to turn. If he doesn't turn, he's literally dead, right? So you indicate to the guy, I can't turn. And so in this case, if you yank the rates, 20%, 10%, 50%, 70%, 120%, if you yank them all over the place, you're basically saying, that's a steering wheel. I can't negotiate with you. Your companies have to move here. So yeah, that's an interesting question, where at some point the companies, you know, they can't walk away from the U.S. market, because the U.S. is one quarter of the world economy. I don't think Americans understand how dominant we are. We are, you know, a quarter of the world market. We tend to be the highest income consumers. So you make, like, there's a lot of industries where you make all your profit in the U.S. and then everything else is just gravy on top of that. So they can't walk away. So if they can't walk away and the tariffs could be 70% tomorrow, at some point you say, you know what, screw it. Just build a factory in North Carolina. The wages are cheap. The energy's cheap. The energy's like a third the cost of Germany, half the cost of Japan. Just pull the trigger. So it may be intentional, basically holding the steering wheel out the window.
That's interesting. Okay, so my last sort of topic I wanted to cover with you is just broadly the U.S. economy, because I've seen you've done a number of videos on. I didn't even like prepare this question exactly, but I saw you talking about like number of college grads who are not who aren't able to find employment in their in their field of study or at all, probably in many cases. Obviously, like rising healthcare prices, you go down the list. I feel a bit insulated as a Bitcoiner. I feel a little bit insulated from what I see on some of your videos, for example. But the data suggests that there are a lot of people struggling. And we've seen unemployment at like the big tech companies. AI is going to obviously replace many, at the very least, I think most people agree, a lot of white collar jobs are probably going away because of AI, at least over the next few years. Like what's your take on what is actually happening on Main Street that maybe you don't hear in the political narratives, that you don't see on mainstream news? And what do you think this looks like for the next, you know, 5-10 years? Does it get better? Does it get worse? Do they just blow $1 trillion at the problem? What's the exit for it?
Yeah, I think economically, economically we are in one of the golden ages of all history because of technology, not because of the government. The government is trying to screw it up as much as they can. And, you know, this is partly things like AI, computers, the internet, even just computers and the internet. They have not finished raising productivity, raising incomes. A lot of it is foreign countries. You know, so if you go back 30 years ago, roughly 1 billion people in the world were really productive in the global economy. Now it's like 4 or 5 billion. You get innovations, you get, you know, if you look at Chinese manufacturing, for example, it's genuinely impressive. There's a lot of fields where the Chinese are actually leading edge. A couple of years ago, the city of Akron wanted to have like a 100-year anniversary of highlighting Akron's history in glass. They were like the Silicon Valley of glass 100 years ago. So they were going to build this curved glass wall to you know, show off, because that was invented in Akron. The thing is that no American company can make a curved glass wall. It's a 100-year-old technology. Nobody can make it here. So they had to buy it from China. You know, Akron, Ohio did not want to buy from China.
Right.
Because that was going to be in the news. These are all union guys. Okay. They tried. Impossible. So if you look at it from a technology perspective, I think we are in absolutely a golden age in terms of rising incomes. The government is, of course, going to try to take everything it can. But again, putting that in perspective, governments have been rapacious for 100 years. There have been many times when people thought that the end was nigh and, you know, it gets postponed. And the reason is that what governments are doing is parasiting some of that technological advancement, right? Like with China, right? They gobble it up. They pay the cronies. They buy the wars. They do all this. So what they end up doing is, you know, tech moves us 3 steps. Government knocks that back 1. I think most likely that process is going to continue. I think the biggest fear that people have right now is jobs, specifically with AI. But it's not just AI, right? It's factory automation. You know, if you look at the jobs lost since 2000 in manufacturing, for example, only about a third of that was China. 2/3 of that was automation, right? So if you go into an American factory nowadays, remember I visited a rubber factory in Kentucky a couple of years ago, and it's amazing, right? Every workstation had either 1 guy or 0 guys, just having a little alarm that would call a guy over if something went wrong. You had like, I don't know, 15 steps that each had 0 to 1 person. And then you had a last step called flashing where they cut off the little nipples on the rubber, okay? And that had like 80 women sitting there with scissors, right? And you're just looking at this thing and like, you can see the process, right? One by one, they replaced, you know, because each of those steps probably had 10, 20, 30 people. So, you know, it was a 7,000 person factory and it shrink, 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 shrink. So that's all going to continue. But that's been going on for 150 years. Arguably, it's been going on for a lot longer than that. You know, in ancient Greece, they worried about oxen replacing farm workers, and they'd have all these extra men who wouldn't be able to raise a family, so you'd have to send them to war or else they're going to cause trouble. In medieval Europe, it was water wheels and windmills were going to take all the jobs away. The Industrial Revolution, of course, that was going to wipe out all the jobs. The internet was going to take away all the jobs. It was going to replace all the white-collar workers with spreadsheets and Word documents. Every single time, right? Thousands of years of automation. Every single time what happens out the other end is that you find new jobs because human wants are unlimited. And those jobs pay much, much better. So it's an escalator. So what happens is the automation is the escalator, but every so often you have to take a step down. So you used to be an accountant. Now you have to drive for Uber. But the thing is that the automation itself is raising the wages. So if you look at the Industrial Revolution, for example, a farm worker today, if they're American, they make about $25. If they're like an illegal, they make more like $15. Okay, compare that to what a farm worker made in 1800, right? In modern terms. I mean, it was like $14 a day, right? So even the jobs that step down, the automation picks it up. The problem is that the timing doesn't matter. Right. So, you know, you do have accountants who have to go drive for Uber. I just saw a statistic that the average babysitter in the U.S. makes over $20 an hour. Right. Babysitting is just about the lowest skilled job possible. You can be a 16-year-old in high school with no experience and you can babysit. $20 an hour. Right. That's striking. So, you know, people aren't, they're not going to starve to death. The automation is going to create more jobs because automation makes you richer. As you get richer, middle-class people consume things that only rich people used to consume. So consider that today, even like the poorest Americans, people on welfare, they get their nails done, they get their hairs done. They don't raise their own chickens, okay? They go to the store and they effectively hire butchers. They hire farmers to raise chickens. They hire butchers. They hire, you know, people to bring it. Many cases to bring it literally to their door. This is a level of services. This is the poorest people in America do this, right? Yeah. They use like Uber Eats, you know, so, and this is what happens in a rich society is that services spread, you know, also as the society gets richer, people have more stuff, you know, so the average house in America in 1950 was 950 square feet. Like, if you think of how big that is,
yeah.
Now, as like a one-bedroom apartment, the average house today is like 2,500 square feet. So stuff gets bigger. People have second homes. They have swimming pools. They need the pool guy. They need the electrician. They got more to go wrong. The fundamentally demand increases for all of the other jobs that AI does not replace. And so what's fascinating to me is that it's almost an inverse of the Industrial Revolution. So the Industrial Revolution wiped out physical labor. And so, but it made everybody much richer because, you know, a tractor is 50 times more efficient. So everybody got rich, but the blue collars got knocked down. And when the smoke cleared, blue collars today make much more, you know, 7-10 times more than they did, but white collars make 50 times more, right? So if you look at what's the equivalent of a professor before the Industrial Revolution, it was some crazy guy sitting in a park yelling about stuff. I mean, literally, right? That's what the philosophers were in ancient Greece. They were effectively homeless, like Socrates. One of them lived in a barrel, right? So these white-collar jobs were not valuable before the Industrial Revolution. What happened is we got rich. A certain amount of that was siphoned off by special interests who then funneled it into universities or, you know, medical care, of course, advanced. So being a doctor is much more, it requires a lot more brain work than it did in, you know, 1800. So on. So it the escalator went up for everybody, right? Even blue collars in America have air conditioning. However, it reshuffled. And what I think is going to happen with AI is going to reshuffle the other direction. So very specifically, highly educated, high income, older, by the way, white women. So Karen, if you look at the demographic profile, they are like ground zero. What's also fascinating to me is if you think about the people who write AI doom porn, okay, so professors, people who work at think tanks, journalists, okay, everybody who writes AI doom porn is 100% the people who are going to get replaced by AI.
Sure.
Plumbers are not writing AI doom porn, right? So they are terrified of a world, like already today, the plumber makes more than the journalist. He might make more than the professor. They're terrified of a world where the DoorDash girl makes more than them, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what happens with AI. So again, the escalator goes up because AI makes everything so efficient. It cuts prices. Now, you know, people always say, no, AI is BS. It's just pretending. It's mimicking what it read on Reddit. Okay, fine. If that's the case, then false alarm. Forget about it. AI is not going to do anything. But I think it is pretty significant because I use it every day. It is brilliant. It is as smart as the best economists. You know, people used to ask me these like really far out sci-fi questions, like what happens if, and you know, I'd be like, oh no, this is a good challenge. Let me see. And now like I ask AI and I'm like, yeah, I didn't think about that. Okay. It's freaking brilliant. I can say as a practitioner. So I think that AI is absolutely going to change things. Specifically, it's going to do what the Industrial Revolution did, but this time it's going to dethrone the white collars, who tend to be Democrats. They tend to be influential. They tend to, you know, they're the ones who influence institutions and the government and the AI doom porn. So I think that there will be an institutional backlash to it because, right, when the Industrial Revolution came, the guys who pitched hay, they couldn't stop it. The most they could do was like burn down factories every so often, right? The Luddites in this AI, okay, this is the ruling class. This is the elite who's getting dethroned. So I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. I'm there with the popcorn.
Yeah, I probably tend to agree with that. And the amazing thing is a lot of it's going to end up being open sourced, and it's like Bitcoin. It's like anything that they try to do to stop it, there's going to be a workaround. Someone in another country that isn't, you know, doesn't fall under the king is going to figure something out and open source it. So I lied to you. I was going to ask, I said that was the last topic. I do want to ask, in everything we've discussed, right? We've got war, we've got AI, geopolitical turmoil, tariffs, all these things. What does all of this mean in aggregate? You have to go one by one for Bitcoin. And is there a reason you think, do you look at Bitcoin adoption as, you know, you're bullish on where we're going over the next 12 months? I don't really care about price too much, but are you kind of think we're done with the stickiness of, you know, the $60,000, $70,000 range here soon? Or what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, price, I have no idea.
That's the right answer. That's correct.
Yeah. I think adoption continues. I think adoption got a little bit of a slowdown simply because the paper hand tourists are playing in silver. They're not anymore, but for a while there, they were playing in silver and gold and other things. So, you know, I think that's why price took a hit recently. But having said, in the long run, you know, the long-term adoption, I think, is still solid. I think it's interesting that, you know, when we talk about the potential crises, the solution to all of those because of central banking is inflation. So like every crisis can, in a sense, be translated into inflation, which means that every crisis accrues to Bitcoin. So I think in the long run, I mean, certainly as a hedge, you know, anybody who's invested in stocks or something, I think absolutely has to have a chunk in Bitcoin. But I think as time goes on, you know, all of those crises, like each crisis gives a boost to Bitcoin price and also the Bitcoin adoption. And then sort of the meta question is, can fiat go on forever? You know, is there some point where the inflation, you know, the crises get big enough that the inflation gets runaway? There's some point, like 50% a year, where inflation tends to accelerate very rapidly. People just dump all their cash. And if we get to that point, which has happened many, many times in history, right? I mean, history is really just a cycle, right? Where you have inflation and then everybody wises up and goes to gold. Then you get inflation again, they wise up and go to gold, and you do it again and again. And of course, it's a cycle because every time they go to gold, you know, the fundamental problem with gold is that in the modern day, you can't have a currency that is literally gold coins. It's too expensive. You have to have some currency, whether it's electronic or paper, that's backed by gold. Now, the problem is that if you back it with gold, you can't say that your gold is in a secret place and you can't tell anybody where it is. Right. You have to give the address. You have to show the camera with the sharks with the lasers on their heads. And so you have to show it. And once you do that, government is going to give you a visit, and they're going to have opinions about what you should do with this gold. It's very risky to leave it here. Why don't you leave it with us over at the Fed, in which case it'll be rehypothecated, it'll be re-lent out. Right. So it'll be gone. I think it's ironic because for gold bugs, they say that the reason why Bitcoin is BS and gold rocks is because gold is physical, right? You can drop it on your foot. It's real. You can hold it. Okay. But that is also the reason why it is terminally vulnerable to government seizure. The government doesn't have to seize it. They just have to have opinions about what you should do with it next. And so for that reason, we keep going through this cycle. What is exciting for me about Bitcoin is that once you get into Bitcoin, you don't have to get out, right? Because government cannot capture it. So then the question becomes, okay, well, you know, if fiat is going to die, which it on a long enough timeline, it will. The question is, you know, when does that happen? If it happens like in the next 10 years, which I think is extremely unlikely, then we go to gold. because there's some institutional memory, because the older people who have more influence on the world are still gold bugs, okay, over the next 10 years. If the end doesn't come for 30 years, then I think at that point, it's more likely that you go to Bitcoin. Because if you look at young people who understand central banking, who care about the basement, almost none of them are in gold.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you know, almost like, I guess 45 or 50 is roughly the dividing point. I used to say 40, but that was 5 years ago. So let's call it 45 is the dividing point. Anybody over 45 or 50, they just want to hear about gold. Anybody under that age, they just want to hear about Bitcoin. So ironically, in a sense, Bitcoiners should be rooting for the fiat system to keep going a little bit longer so that the gold bugs flip over to Bitcoin. Now, having said, if it does happen in the next 10 years and we go to gold, then at that point, you know, even the people who own gold, I think, are going to be much more receptive to switching over to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin at this point has a lower inflation rate than gold. Right? Gold is mined, I think, around 1.2 or 1.5% a year. So effectively, its inflation rate, whereas Bitcoin is now below that. So even if we do go in the next 10 years, I think we revert to gold as we have hundreds of times through history. And then at that point, you know, Bitcoin continues eroding the market share of gold. So yeah. I think either way, yeah, if we zoom out 30, 50 years, I think there's a very good chance that we'll have a Bitcoin standard.
Yeah, I think in a worst case scenario, if we had to, if we were to migrate to something like a gold standard or migrate to gold as like a more meaningful aspect of commerce, I think very quickly we realize, oh, maybe this could have worked in the 1970s, but not in the digital, not in the digital global economy that we have in, you know, 2020 or 2030 or 2035 or yeah. something. So I think yeah. we spin out of gold pretty quickly. Would be my guess.
You necessarily have to decentralize gold because it's made of atoms. You have to store it somewhere. And once you store it somewhere, it's centralized. It's got all the vulnerabilities.
Makes sense. Alrighty, my last question for you, Peter. Promise this time. What is an unpopular opinion that you have and you get some bonus points if you offend Bitcoiners with it?
Okay, so offense. I don't know how offensive this is to Bitcoiners. So I think that as much as Bitcoiners hate the Fed is the best salesman, the best promoter on earth for Bitcoin. You know, if we had a system where either central banks were disciplined and careful and were actually protecting the dollar, which they did for a minute in like 1920, if we either had that system or if we were already on a gold standard, then I think that it would be much harder to get people to appreciate and understand the power of Bitcoin. So, you know, in a sense, Bitcoin is created by central banking. It's sustained by central banking. I hate central banks. The Fed is Bitcoin's biggest champion. And the worse the Fed gets, you know, the more incompetent it gets, the more that helps our case.
So it was the curse that instigated the origin of Bitcoin, and now it's the blessing that demonstrates why we need Bitcoin so very badly.
Bitcoin would not exist if not for the creature of Jekyll Island.
Yeah, well said. All right, Peter, thank you so much for your time, man. Why don't you tell people where they can find you, read your Substack, listen to your podcast, anything else you want to send them to?
Yep. So I make daily videos, a little 3.5 minute shticks on liberty and freedom. Or liberty and economics, rather. Those go up on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. I also do deep dives every week on ProfSaintAnge.com, and I do a podcast where I round up all the videos at PeterSaintAnge.com.
I love it. Everyone needs to check these out. You learn a lot very quickly. I think you're, I'll tell you just a personal story. I've got a sister who's a teacher, and I've sent her your videos like 20 times. I'm like, you need to do this in your domain. Like this, like these 3-5 minute videos, people love these things. It's something about them just like connects.
What's funny about it is that you can get really deep on stuff because it's only like 3.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Pick so like a single thing.
Yeah. Like people don't get tired. Right.
Yeah.
So like if I do something on like central banking and M2, you know, money supply and then how that relates to inflation, if you're doing that for 20 minutes, especially at like 8 in the morning, no.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
No way.
Harder
right?
to do.
So, it's got to be short. It's got to be as simple as possible. You know, so you can explain difficult concepts to people. But I think there's a ton of fields where there's massive appetite for that. you know, whether it's psychology, anything to do with science. There's a lot of people who, you know, they just love learning different things like paleontology or chemistry or whatever. I think there's huge appetite for it.
Yeah, we need a Peter St. Ange doing 3-minute videos in every discipline. And, you know, everyone would be a lot smarter. So, Peter, thank you so much for your time. We'll catch up again soon.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Peter. I know I did. He's an awesome guy to talk to. Go check out his videos. His 3 to 5 minute daily videos he does are incredible, incredibly informative. And you learn a lot just sitting down and listening to an expert for a few minutes every single day. Of course, if you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We will walk you through what it is we do, how we do it, why you need to be your own bank, and we can train you and get you across the finish line to do just that. And of course, if you need help with online privacy, setting up your privacy phone, we have a Plan B residency option. So all of your self-sovereignty needs, we've got you covered. Again, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a time. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.